Interstate Batteries has been a proud supporter of the Sportsman's Nation since day one. With over 200,000 locations throughout the U.S. and offering 12,000 different types of batteries, stop into your local Interstate Battery store today and let them help you find the right batteries for your everyday life.
This is a Houndsman XP podcast with your host, Steve Fielder, and me, Chris Powell. If you're ready to up your game to extreme performance, sit back, buckle up, and hang on for another exciting episode of Houndsman XP. Welcome to the Houndsman XP podcast, and today your host, Chris Powell, me, and Steve Fielder is on the other end of this line, and we have got a very special guest today with Mr. Gary Robertson from Menard, Texas. You might more than likely recognize that name. He's the producer of Carnivore TV and one of the owners of, are you the sole owner of Burnham Brothers, Gary?
I guess I'm the sole owner. No one else wants it, so I'm it.
Well, Gary, it's an honor to have you on the show. I know you've been a houndsman for several years, and just kind of want to start out with talking a little bit about Carnivore TV, because I found that on the Pursuit Up channel. I was actually watching it before you moved it over to that app, and so how many seasons have you had Carnivore TV on now?
We're shooting our ninth season. So we've aired eight, and we're in the process of shooting number nine right now. And, of course, we air on the Pursuit channel in the third and fourth quarters, so July through the end of December. Like I say, we're shooting season number nine, and having a little trouble this year battling the weather. It's been a little wetter down here in Texas than what we're used to, and I don't like to be, you know, it's not good for the camera. So, you know, when it rains, we've got to be indoors.
Yeah, yeah. So, what part of Texas are you from there, Gary? I know you're from one part of Texas and you live in another part of Texas now. So where are we talking to you from today?
Well, I was raised in South Texas, about 50 miles southwest of San Antonio. But I live in the hill country and have since 1985. Most people, you know, they say, oh, you're from Menard. That's West Texas. But I'm within 20 miles of the geodetic center of the state. So if you put your finger right where you think the center of Texas might be, chances are I would be under it.
Yeah. Yeah. I did a little bit of research on Menard, Texas. It's the home of the Jim Bowie Trail Ride. I found that out. What is that?
Jim Bowie, who was, of course, you know, what, somewhat of a Texas legend, and died at the Alamo, made several trips up into Menard County, back, you know, in the 1800s. He was convinced that there was silver here, and I don't think it was ever mined here, but I think perhaps silver had been, you know, moved here or stored here, maybe perhaps by the Spaniards, moving it out of, you know, out of New Mexico or further west, mm-hmm, in an attempt to, you know, put it on ships headed back to Spain. But anyway, whether it was Indians or Spaniards or whoever, that someone came, supposedly convinced him that there was silver here. So he made several trips up into this country.
Yeah, so
well, Gary,
go ahead, Steve. You've got something you need to throw in there on that.
Yeah, I apologize for interrupting there. I think Chris and I have been working on a system to prevent that from happening, but I guess words are traveling slow today. But at any rate, Gary, I was privileged to, as we had discussed earlier, to spend a year of my life out there in West Texas and really enjoyed that part of the world. And you have a unique place. Of course, many of our listeners are hounds people, and you have a unique place to coon hunt out there for sure. I think most of the coons that we chased ended up in a mesquite tree or in a badger hole. So,
yes, sir.
But, yeah, that's a beautiful part of the country. It's rugged, almost semi-desert country, isn't it?
Yes, sir, it is. Like I say, until this year, and then it seems to have changed, but, This country typically, you know, your average rainfall here in Menard County would be about 21 to 22 inches. And what we do here is, of course, we hunt coon because that's what we have. My love is hunting lion and mountain lion. And, of course, there's a few here, rarely one seen here, killed here, but as we go west, the populations increase, and that's what I like to do is chase those lions. So what I do in this country is train my dogs on coon and keep them in shape, and I hunt daylight only. And the reason that I hunt daylight is pretty simple. You know, you go out in the morning about daybreak, and most of the tracks that you hit were made that night. So that dog has to learn patience, slow them down a little bit, and be able to, you'll find out what kind of nose they have when it hasn't rained here in 3 months, and you kick them out and expect them to trail a coon across dirt. But that's the way we evaluate these dogs, because when you carry them out west, conditions are generally worse, unless we get up in the mountains, and then, of course, you know, the mountains can, you know, the scent seems to hold better there. But if you go into West Texas, goodness gracious, I think that's the toughest place I've ever tried to trail anything. And of course, you're trailing across a lot of rock. And rock, as you know, doesn't hold scent very well. But that's what we do with these dogs. We train them on coon and then find out what kind of nose they've got. And you know, we think they can handle it, then we haul them out west. But the cool thing is you go out west where we have a lot of lion and there's no coon. And we've got these dogs broke. So about the only thing they're going to get after, of course, is that lion or a bobcat. They'll run cat too.
Well, Gary, I can attest to that because when I was in San Angelo, very much bitten by the coon hunting bug back east, my dad shipped out a plot to me, and he had a lot of trouble cold trailing or trailing at all out there for a while. You know, he would hang in there with the walker dogs that I was hunting with, and there was a dog named Bugler that belonged to Robert Knox that could put his nose in that old West Texas dirt and smell a track, I think the kind that you're talking about, and drift that track out. And when he got it running, then the little plot dog could get in there. And I used to laugh at the guys because he was real quick on the tree. And of course, they'd tell me, well, he would have never known that tree was there if these walkers hadn't have moved it that far. And that's absolutely true. But, yeah, I can definitely identify with what you're talking about. The only cats we got into out there were ringtail cats, which I'd never seen. Do you want to talk a little bit about them, or is that too mild?
Well, no, I grew up, of course, I had one as a pet when I was a youngster. And, you know, they're typical of this country. You don't find those, you know, you'll find them in South Texas and in West Texas and up through this hill country, and that's about it. They make great pets. They're very clean. They're pretty intelligent. They're much smaller than a coon. They'll weigh up to 4 pounds, probably 3-4 pounds. Most of them is tail. They have a long tail that's, you know, striped like a coon, but longer. And their body is, you know, lighter tan in color. And they kind of have bug eyes. But and if you get one spooked, you know, they don't smell quite as bad as a skunk, but they sure give off an odor. And I sure don't like my dogs to mess with them. Occasionally we'll have a young dog that will, but usually it doesn't take me long to convince that dog he doesn't need to be playing with that ringtail.
You know, Texas.
But the dogs
is,
that we use.
Go ahead and finish that, Gary.
I was just going to kind of go back to what the type of dogs we use. I raise blue tick dogs. My great grandfather started the South Texas Wolf Hunters Association, and of course they weren't hunting wolves; they were chasing coyotes with running walker dogs, primarily some Julys. Back in the 1920s, and it got to be such a big deal that Time and Life magazine would come down and cover that event. I have a Life magazine from December in 1936 when Time and Life both covered the South Texas Wolf Hunters meet at Cotulla, Texas. And I would bet that was probably the last time that Time or Life covered anything to do with hunting.
No doubt about that.
No doubt.
I used to take Life magazine when I was a kid, and I really enjoyed the photos and stuff, but I don't ever remember anything to do with hunting or anything like that. That's kind of unique for sure.
Very unique. But to show how far my roots go back with hound hunting, that I'm sure, you know, some of my ancestors before him were hunters, but that's about as far back as I can document it. My grandfather had a running walker dog by the name of Tulsa that was rather famous. He won not only the hunt, I think two different times. He was also the bench show champion, and he had the classic bugle mouth that everybody tried to breed for. In fact, his mouth was so famous that Walt Disney came down and recorded that dog running a coyote at Cotulla, Texas. Mm. And that is the soundtrack that they used in the movie Voice of Bugle Ann.
Oh, man, that's one that I didn't see the movie, but I read the book. And that was a tremendous story.
I'll be finding the movie now. I'm gonna look for that on Prime and just so I can hear old Tulsa hitting the high ball there.
I used to have several 78 records that were made of, you know, recordings of him running a coyote. And I'm not sure where they disappeared to, but I remember listening to him as a kid. And I don't have a 78 record player anymore. So those days may be gone.
Gary, I have a quick question for you about the lion population out there. And I've heard, and I think in conversations with our mutual friend, Kenneth Hemphill, who I've learned from you has recently passed, talking about the encroachment or the migration of the mountain lion into that West Texas area. To my knowledge, in 69 and 70, when I was there, there were no lions around there. At least if so, nobody talked about it, or we certainly didn't see any signs of them. What's been going on with that?
Well, this was, as you know, this was sheep and goat country. And for 100 years, they did everything they could to remove all the coyotes and all the bobcats, and they sure didn't want lion here. Lion is not a protected species in Texas. It is, they are treated just like any other predator.
Even in 2000, even today, you're saying they're not protected there, Gary?
Even today.
Wow.
There's no season on them. There's no bag limit. But I'm 66 years old, and there's more lion today in Texas than at any time in my life. And it just goes back to there's less predator control than there used to be because, like I say, less, you know, less people trying to make a living with livestock. And especially there's so many so much of this country has been bought up by absentee landowners. They're interested in hunting and they're interested in recreation, but not so much about controlling the predators. So that is the reason I think that we see the populations increasing. And let's face it, you know, most of the old lion hunters that I knew growing up, they're long gone, and there's no one stepped up to take their place. There's just not that many guys out chasing them anymore. So,
well, Gary, when you say absentee landowner, you're referring to a person that owns a ranch or property there and then doesn't live on it or lives out of state. Are you having a lot of out of state people buying ranches in Texas, or has that been a long time trend down there?
That's not been a huge problem where I am. Most of these landowners or people that are buying land here are coming from Houston or Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're a high percentage are coming from Midland, you know, out of the oil field, because let's face it, those big folks are making a lot of money now.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're buying up a lot of this property as, you know, as an old rancher retires or, you know, or he passes and it goes to the next generation. A lot of those heirs, you know, made a living somewhere else, and they're not so much interested in holding on to these, you know, these ranches anymore. So we're seeing it sell to folks that most of them are Texas folks, but they do not live here.
Well, Gary, you mentioned these older ranchers. When I was there, I would go up to Robert Lee, Texas, and hunt with a gentleman named Ed Bagwell. And maybe you've met Ed or heard about him. I know that he passed away in recent years. Ed was a foreman on, I think, 40 sections of land up there on the ranch that he worked by horseback. And we would go up and find Ed eating his supper at about dark, and he would load hounds in that old Ford F-150 with the cattle rack on the back, and we'd go out bouncing through those dry washes around those tanks and seeing usually more rattlesnake eyes than we did coon eyes. But when you say old ranchers, it brings back a lot of memories for me.
Yes, so, sir. I knew of Ed, but I never hunted with him. Robert Lee is about a little over 100 miles north of here. And, you know, I typically hunted a little closer to the house if I was coon hunting. Sure. I never got in competition game to speak of, because the dogs that work well for lion are, you know, these are trailing dogs that they need to be work somewhat as a team. I don't want them to be so independent that, you know, they won't honor each other, because it takes teamwork. A lot of good things have to happen on the ground before we get to worry about that tree. And it seems that a lot of the competition dogs are, you know, they're worried about tree. Well, like I say, there's a whole lot of good things that have to happen on the ground in this country before we can even worry about a tree. So a lot of the qualities that are in the competition dogs, I don't necessarily like to see in my dogs. I want them to work together, and I want them to work that old bad track and be, you know, somewhat independent if they're right and they know it, to stick with it. But if they're not getting anything done and another dog's hitting out ahead of them, they better get there if they want to stay in the race. So that's the type of dogs that I like to, you know, work with.
Sounds like you would have fit right in with the Lee brothers and Ben Lilly and Montague Stevens and some of those guys, Gary.
Well, it's a shame I don't live a little further west. I've thought about, you know, if I ever retire, slow down, perhaps moving further west where I can get up and just go hunt every day. And I like to hunt horseback if I can, but, you know, I hunt a tremendous amount in the Navajo Reservation now. And, And the reason I do is it's so big, and you can get a land permit out there for $250, but there's 17 and a half million acres in that reservation. Unfortunately, there's hundreds of thousands of wild horses, and those wild horses don't take well to horses that are brought in. So we generally just go up there and road hunt these dogs, you know, miles and miles and miles of roads up in those mountains.
Now, where is that reservation located, Gary?
The Navajo Reservation is just south of the Four Corners. Most of it is in northeast Arizona. It spills over into northwest New Mexico and then goes on up into Utah in the southeast corner there. But beautiful country, and so much of it. In fact, there's a young gentleman that works for me and helps us quite a bit by the name of Calvin Redhouse. And Calvin is a Marine. He did 5 tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I helped get Calvin started in the dog business. And now he's outfitting for lion and bear there in the Navajo. And he's very successful. And he shoots a lot of video for carnivore.
Great, great. Well, I was able to hunt the White Mountain Apache in Arizona for bear with professional guide out there, Tom David, and Summit Outfitters. I don't know if you've met Tom, but he and I had a mutual love for the plot and made an acquaintance, and I was able to go out there one time and enjoyed that a lot. I have a quick question, and then I'm going to yield to Chris. You mentioned your blue ticks. Does the name Tom Broom mean anything to you?
Yes, sir. I never hunted with Tom. He was from Gorman, Texas, which is a couple hours kind of northeast of here. But I knew of some of his dogs. And back in the early 60s, I had some dogs that went back to Tom's dogs.
I see. I figured you would not recognize that name because I heard it a lot when I was in Texas.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Like I say, he was a little, I won't say he was before my time, but I grew up hunting in South Texas. I had my first dogs when I was 10 and just coon hunted, and then kind of morphed from coon hunting into a little more of the running dogs, and I was crossing them with blue dogs and trying to run cat a little bit more, and it did that for a number of years. And then a buddy had some trend walker dogs, and he tried to convince me that was what we needed. And
yeah,
and I had a trend walker dog. I raised them for a few mm-hmm. years, but they were more pure coon dogs, I thought. They didn't work as well for what I was trying to do, and that was chase cat at that time. And nowadays I really kind of about 25 years ago started hunting these blue dogs because they seem to fit this arid country a little better. And then when I started trying to chase lion, well, they sure seem to fit that bill a little better than some of the other hotter nosed dogs.
Well, Gary, you've had quite a successful career in the outdoors and being a houndsman. And I know you've also done some episodes for Carnivore TV about breeding. And how many generations of hounds are you hunting, or do you consider yourself a breeder? You know, just kind of lay that out for us a little bit.
Well, I don't know that I ever considered myself a breeder. I do study genetics, and I don't like, you know, if you have a really good dog, especially a female, I hate to take her out of the pack. So I'll breed a female maybe once a year. And I've been breeding these dogs, well, it's like I say, since about 1990. And so I've got several generations that are bred similarly, and mm-hmm. I line breed the dogs, and I think we did an episode, I think a year or two ago, where I did take a female and had her surgically inseminated.
Right. You got one male pup.
I got one male pup, and I let a buddy hunt him, and I didn't like the way he turned out confirmation wise, and he was a little hard headed, so I did not keep him. You know, that's one thing. You know, a lot of people I've heard say, well, they never worry about a dog's confirmation if he hunts the way you want, but I have found out that if you hunt these dogs like we do and ask them to go 30 to 50 miles in a day, these dogs have to be put together right.
Mm-hmm.
And if not, they cripple up and they won't make it. They'll make it maybe a day or two. But I loaned a dog to a buddy of mine up in New Mexico to lion hunt. He was trying to get started, and he was a really nice male dog. And they hunted that dog 21 days straight. He said, of course, they were hunting well with other dogs, but he said that was the only dog that could do it.
Yeah.
And so these dogs have to have a little, they've got to be put together right, and they've got to have a little leg under them.
Well, you're talking about line breeding, Gary, and of course, you've got a pretty unique situation out there. The things that you're asking from your hounds compared to what most Eastern houndsmen have. So line breeding is a term that gets thrown around a lot and probably misunderstood, but just, can you talk a little bit about the kind of traits that you're looking for, to include in a breeding program, and then what, how you're using those traits? I know that some of your, I don't know how much, I haven't studied your pedigrees, but I, when I think of Gary Robertson, I think of Clear River Diamond Jim. So kind of take us back through that a little bit and describe what you're looking for and how you're using those traits, what you're looking for in the traits, and how you're using it to make some of those breeding choices.
Well, I have used Clear River Diamond Jim. I bred to him when he was, I think, a four-year-old dog, you know, in Oklahoma, when Jim Smalling owned him. And I took a really nice female that was heavy, heavy Smoky River. She had a little Vaughn in her, and also quite a bit of Dennis Upson's breeding out of Wisconsin. Dennis, you know, hunts coon a little, but he's primarily a bear hunter. And I really, that Upson breeding that he had, I thought those dogs had excellent conformation. And I kind of like those pretty dogs that have a tremendous amount of drive and desire to go, but yet they can't be too independent. Like I say, mm-hmm. if you get and I've seen some dogs that are independent to a fault, no matter what's going on around them, you know, they won't quit what they're doing. But I think first and foremost, you have to have a dog that's intelligent.
Mm-hmm.
No matter, above everything else, they need to be smart. And as far as the next trait, I guess I would say drive, you know, never, you know, not to quit.
Right.
To be almost hard-headed to a fault, you know, if they can still smell it, to stick in there and work and try to work that track out. You know, I've hunted with a lot of bobcat hunters in South Texas, and they use primary running dogs, and, you know, they kind of laugh at some of my blue dogs.
That's okay. You know, everybody laughs at blue dogs.
Does.
And I'm a blue dog, and I'm a blue tick man, so I can say that.
But, you know, they don't really want their dogs to trail. There's so many bobcat down there in that country, and I hunt down there quite a bit, that we'll go down the road, we'll strike the bobcat track, and they'll let their dogs mess with it at maybe 5 or 10 minutes. And if they don't get it jumped and running, they're honking them back to the road. And we're going to road them down the road because they know we're going to strike another one, you know, probably 400, maybe half a mile down the, you know, yards, or to half a mile down the road. So it's no big deal. They want to hear a jump race, and that's fine. I like to hear one too.
Mm-hmm.
But that, you know, they're also going to have 20 dogs on the ground. Yeah. And I hunt 4 to 6 when I'm line hunting. Right now I'm hunting 8 around here because I've got a couple of young dogs that I'm bringing up. In fact, from that litter that we did, that insemination, and we'll see how they turn out. But drive, intelligence and drive, and then third, they've got to have a nose, and of course they've got to know how to use it. But I think that goes back to intelligence.
Well, there's no sense in,
let's face it.
Go ahead.
Some dogs may be able to smell, but they don't really want to cold trail. You know, you've got to have a dog that's willing to make that extra effort to trail, because, you know, we can hit a coon track and, you know, if, especially if we hunt after dark, there's plenty of coon in this country. We can hit them and they can run a hot track. But you don't hit many line tracks hot. You get real lucky to do that. Most of the time it's, you know, that track's going to be made during the night and you're in there the next morning, or it may be the day before. And, you know, that old lion can make a lot of tracks in a day. So, that old dog's got to be willing to work from behind, and you'll find out a lot about not only your dogs, but what, you know, conditions do. The barometric pressure, how it affects you. And of course, wind is always a problem out here, but, that's all interesting and just part of the game that a lot of guys, if they're coon hunting back east where you've got a, you know, big coon population and there's always moisture, you don't ever have to deal with that.
Well, you know, Gary, you bring up a lot of, I have a lot of the same feelings that you have, having grown up hunting bear in the eastern mountains. And even though, yes, there generally is more moisture out there than what you have in West Texas, we would also encounter dry conditions where the leaves were constantly churning, no rain for several days. The dogs would strike a track along a creek and would seemingly be able to take it. Once they got up on the hillside, the track would break down. When we would begin our training season in August and all the greenery that we have to deal with out east, presents its own trailing problems, because when the frost would hit and the leaves were down and the weeds were killed out, it seems like the dogs could just grab another gear as far as being able to cold trail. But I will have to concede to you that the conditions that I saw out there in West Texas were probably the most severe that I've seen. And I've hunted actually in eastern Arizona. I hunted in the Lincoln Forest in southern New Mexico under pretty dry conditions as well. But you mentioned something earlier that I would like to revisit with you just for a second about confirmation. You know, in my work with the registries all those years, I was also commissioned, so to speak, to develop bench shows and train judges. And when I went to the AKC, I had to provide the education for these show judges that had never seen a coonhound other than a black and tan. And I tried to stress the importance of confirmation. It's good to hear, for me, to hear you talk about it as being an important trait, because certainly if that dog does not have the proper confirmation, he's not going to be able to work in the way that he was bred to do. So just glad that you brought that up, and a lion hunter in West Texas seeing the same idea about that I do. That's refreshing to me, buddy.
There's no sense in hunting an ugly one, I can tell you that.
Well, if you have your choice, there's not.
That's right.
Well, you know, Gary, guys will say that all day. You know, I don't care about looks, but when they walk up to a pen full of pups, they'll pick the prettiest one out of the litter every time.
I've never seen anybody pick the ugliest one.
That's right. No.
you were visited some about carnivore, and yes, we try to do about 4 episodes a year on using dogs, and of course, we've typically done 1 every year at least with hog hunting. That's gotten huge in this part of the world.
I just watched an episode last night about hogs.
It's gotten so big because, you know, there, when I moved here in 1985, there wasn't a wild hog in this county. Now we can go out in the morning and we might catch 15 hogs with dogs. And these, most of them are cur dogs. We're not using many hounds. We're using a few plots. They need to be grittier kind of dogs. They don't need to have great noses on them because the hog stinks pretty good, as you know. But I think the reason for the growth in the hog hunters is simply because all of these landowners have them and no one wants them. So if you've got dogs, you know, people come to you and they'll ask you to come hunt on their place. You know, so it's easy to gain access to these ranches, you know, if you're hunting. But it's crazy. But yeah, we love dogs, and so we're going to continue to do 3 to 4 episodes. We might even do 5 in a year if we come across good stories. This, what we try to do on carnivore is, yes, we're going to be hunting, but if you watch carnivore, most episodes we're telling a story. We try to be cinematic. We'll build the story around where we're hunting or who we're hunting with, or we even did a story, built it around a dog one time. That's what we have found works well for us. And we have a lot of viewers. We air on the Pursuit Channel in 34 quarters. Then we take those same episodes and run them on Hunt TV or the Hunt Channel. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, nowadays, if you want to watch carnivore, you can download a free app that's called Pursuit Up, and you can watch carnivore whenever you want. Just go to Pursuit Up, click on hunting, and then scroll down to carnivore, click on that. Then you pick which episode you want to watch. And I think we probably have more viewers on Pursuit Up than anywhere else in this day and time.
Well, I downloaded.
And who would have thought it?
Yeah, I downloaded that app, Gary, onto my smart TV. So now I just sit in the easy chair. And like I said last night, I watched an episode on hog hunting, and that was real interesting. But you mentioned Calvin Redhouse. He's going to be on the show coming up shortly. I'm working out some details with him right now. But, you know, one of the things I wanted to talk about, Gary, is for anybody that doesn't know you, and I've just met you at the NRA show, talked to you a few times on the UKC forum. But the unique thing that I've found about you is I felt like I was talking to somebody that I'd known my whole life, and that speaks to your character. But tell me about mentoring houndsmen, Western houndsmen. I'm not asking you to brag or toot your own horn, but how important is that to you to mentor houndsmen? You mentioned, you know, giving a dog to a guy in New Mexico that was trying to get started. So I think that's worthy of a few minutes of our time here to talk about that and how important that is.
Well, I've been blessed to, you know, have been raised on a ranch and grew up hunting. And then, of course, we live in a rural area here, Menard County. The population of this county is 2,200 people. And my wife, Deb, and I have been married for 43 years, and we raised 3 sons. And, of course, all of them are hunters. And, of course, I kept them in the woods. And then, of course, all of their buddies that wanted to go, we kept them in the woods. And so I can't tell you the number of, you know, young people I've drugged to the woods. I know there's a Boy Scout camp just west of here at Fort McKavitt, which is in the county. And for years, they had a summer program with kids that were high school age. And I would take couple of nights a week, I would go out there and we took all of those kids that were in that program, which was usually about 60 every summer. And we took them coon hunting. We felt that that was part of hunting with dogs. Has been done for thousands of years, and that's, you know, all of this country was hunted with dogs.
Right.
That's how they controlled the predator population. We wanted to show them that part of that. And then, unfortunately, someone, you know, complained about it. As you know, there's been a lot of changes in the Boy Scouts, and, mm-hmm. and they didn't want us to take those kids hunting, which I didn't agree with, but I wasn't the one making the decision. So I've worked with a lot of the, like I say, I've kind of fallen in love with the Navajo Nation, and mm-hmm. and I've for surely, like I say, Calvin, I consider him one of my sons. In fact, he calls me dad, and anything that I can do to help him, I'm going to do. Mm-hmm. He has a brother-in-law that's a game warden there in the reservation, and I consider him part of the family. There's also another game warden there that I've given a hound or two to him to kind of get him started. You know, it's a shame. My wife kind of scratches her head that, you know, when we do raise litter of pups, I end up giving most of them away to people that are hunters rather than selling them and apply money to that dog food bill. But
right.
I'm more interested in seeing hunting, and especially hunting with dogs, survive. And if I can just, you know, have a small input in that, then that's what I'm going to do.
Well, I think one of the things that is overlooked a lot of times, or maybe the hidden agenda, not really an agenda, but the underlying message there, you know, you talk about all the kids that you take hunting. We used to have groups that would come out to our place, and all these kids are from the suburbs of Indianapolis, and they'd never had any experience hunting. Most of them had never had any experience in the woods. And I remember several nights where we would take those young kids and these dads, there was a dad's camp, and we would take them out, and I would look behind me, and there would be a trail of all these little headlights coming up behind me, you know, maybe 20 or 30 headlights following me. But the message is, every one of those, there may not be a kid in that bunch that is ever a serious houndsman or even a serious hunter, but when he gets older, then he is going to remember the guy that took him. He's going to put a face to that. And when that is a ballot issue or an issue about hunting, he's going to have more information about what it really is and what it's really about, because that's where our battle is with these non-hunting groups, the people that don't hunt. And I separate that between, yes, anti-hunting and non-hunters. Anti-hunters are the extremists that we're never going to change their mind. But those non-hunters is where we need to focus on, and that's where the real value is of grabbing these young kids and getting them out there and exposing them to hunting.
Yes, sir, you're right. And I think that's what we do somewhat. You met me at the NRA convention last week, and let's face it, a lot of those people that walk through that show are non-hunters. A lot of them are shooters. When I came into this business, I bought out Burnham Brothers in 1991, and of course started attending the SHOT Show, the World Hunting Trade Show, and at that time 75% of the people that were in attendance were hunters. Now, when I go to the SHOT Show, which was last January, the last one I attended, I would say that 25 to 30% of the attendees are actually hunters.
Mm-hmm.
We're seeing a shift from hunters to most people being shooters rather than hunters, and I'm not going to say that's a bad thing, because most of those people are friendly to hunting. But things, times are changing.
Well, and that's not necessarily a bad thing, Gary. When you look at the Pittman-Robertson Fund, the money that's doled out back to the states for fish and wildlife management, that's a tax that's built onto ammunition and firearms. So having those shooters in the sport is a good thing, and it's actually outpacing the dollars that hunters are buying. Because face it, a hunter,
yes, sir.
A hunter, I will buy maybe two boxes of ammo for sighting in my deer rifle and then going hunting, where a shooter is buying ammo by the cases. So those shooters are very important, yes, to the survival of hunting, and we've got to appeal to them and keep them involved for sure. Steve, did you have a thought? Did you have anything you need to add?
You're on the right track with this conversation for sure. In my years of working with the registries and dealing with legislative issues that face hunters and so forth. And I think the point to be made here is that, like Gary taking these kids out and you doing as well. I know when my son was in Scouts through our church program, I would take the kids out at least one night during the fall that came to the scout meeting and take them out on a coon hunt and actually harvest the raccoon and show them how to skin it. We had one little boy lose his dinner watching us skin a coon one time. And then we'd have to hustle and get back to the church in time for the parents to pick the kids up. But all that is so very, very important. And, you know, I wore a lot of hats when I was in the registry business, but I never had any work that was more rewarding personally to me than the work I did legislatively on behalf of dogs and dog owners. So, it's all important if we all do what we can do. And I think that's the main purpose that Chris and I agreed upon when we started this podcast, was to bring hound people together under a common goal, and that's to preserve this sport for future generations. So that's all I've got on that, but I think both you guys are definitely on track.
Well, Gary, anybody that's listening, I mean, you're on here talking about hounds, but you've got a lot of irons in the fire. If you want a job done, find a busy man, I guess, is I've heard that from you, Steve. But talk a little bit about being a Ruger ambassador. I mean, you're not just sponsored by Ruger on the show, but you're on a Ruger ambassador. So can you talk a little bit about what your function is there with Ruger Firearms? And one of the things that appealed to me when I met you up there at the show as we talked about this is Ruger is an American company that still manufactures firearms in the United States. And to me, that's important, being a Marine myself and a patriot. So tell us a little bit about the Ruger Ambassador Program and what you're doing there and what Ruger's doing.
Well, the way I got involved with Ruger is, it's a little bit of a long story, but I was shooting for Savage, and it actually helped develop a rifle for them specifically for the pressure hunting game. And then I had the opportunity to hunt with Mike Pfeiffer, who had just become CEO of Ruger. We were calling coyotes out in New Mexico on a couple of really big ranches that I hunt. And Mike and I hit it off. And after the hunt, he called me and asked if I would, you know, switch over and work with him at Ruger to, you know, develop a predator rifle and also kind of help promote his products.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, I was shooting for Savage, and a good friend by the name of Ron Coburn owned the company, and Ron and I were very close. And I said, well, I don't want to do it, you know, as long as, you know, Ron owns Savage, but if something happens, then I definitely would sure like to, you know, look at making a move. So Ron ended up selling Ruger to an investment group. And
Savage, you mean sold Savage?
Yes, he sold Savage.
Right.
it wasn't long after that then, you know, then I went back to Mike and he invited me and to join Ruger. And of course, is our title sponsor of Carnivore. And as ambassadors, they want us to do some traveling. We do the work, the NRA convention. We'll be working the Eastern Sportsman Show this next year. I do the Texas Trophy Hunter shows. I will be wearing Ruger and, of course, be there with the Ruger presence. They like us. We're to give them about 20 days a year, either promoting at stores or events. So when I go to those events, I want to visit with everyone, and especially the kids. But a lot of people or several people have mentioned that, you know, they like the way that we meet the public, and it's simple. You know, I want to deal with them as the way I would want to be treated. There's no magic here. It's just the golden rule. And if we do that, not only as Ruger ambassadors, but in our daily lives, this world would be a whole lot better place.
Well, I stood back and watched you at the Ruger show, and you're easy to spot. What kind of hat was that you were wearing?
Oh gosh, it's a little lighter than a silver belly, but that particular one, I normally wear a Resistol, but that one's made by Saratelli Hat Company.
Yeah, yeah. And, so you're definitely the sharpest dressed guy in the booth. There's no doubt about that. But I watched you, interact with the public the whole time. I went by the booth a couple times. You were showing people different firearms. You were talking to women and kids, and I mean, it was Ruger has a high class booth, by the way, too. I mean, that is very well put together. And, but I watched you interact with the public, and that's what has drawn me to you, Gary, is what you see is what you get. I just can't say enough about that. Has Ruger got anything in the hopper that you can share with us, or? Well, any big news coming out of Ruger?
Well, we showed 20 new models there at the NRA convention, different SKUs, and you know, I'm a hunter. I'm not so much a shooter, so I like the more traditional weapons, not so much into the AR platforms. But gosh, if a guy wants to use them, that's great. I like to shoot handguns, and that's what I carry when I'm coon hunting or lion hunting for the most part. If we're bear hunting, you know, we might carry the 44 Magnum, in that model 77. And, boy, you talk about handle a bear. When you put that 44 mag in a rifle, it's just a different animal. But, of all the guns that we are just introduced, the one that I feel is going to be by far, in a way, the most popular is the little Wrangler 22 pistol. It is built similar to the hand. It's about the same size as the old single six, but it has an aluminum frame under it, so it's lighter weight.
It was sweet. You took me over there and showed me that one. That felt good in your hand. It's something you can pack. It was a really nice pistol.
You bring buttons. Well, yes. Gary, you know, my dad carried a single six for many, many years. And when he passed in 2008, I took that old gun. And I probably should have left it just like it was, but I had it re-blued in the grips refinished and put it away. And I take it out every once in a while and handle it and remember all the hunts that I took with my dad in that old single six. It's quite a piece. And I think that's what we do, those of us who enjoy and appreciate firearms. The anti-gun lobby will never understand the affinity we can have for something like that. That's just cold steel and wood or composite, but it's the stories that go along with those pieces. And so when you mentioned the single six, that just brought back a flood of memories for me. And what a great, great firearm that was. And our coon hunters across the country really have loved and used the Ruger 10/22. You know, that's been a go-to piece for coon hunters all over the country.
I've got one of those myself.
And I'm going to have one of those Wranglers. And the neat thing about that Wrangler is the price point. As we discussed, Chris, you're probably going to be able to buy that pistol for less than $200.
Yeah. Wow!
And that's pretty amazing.
It really is.
Grooved? Is that tapped or grooved for a scope? I mean, or is it?
It's not. It has. Okay. You know. It's big sights like those, most of the old single six were in the Vaquero. Okay. Most of those, I don't know, I guess they're machines so that they generally shoot, the sights generally don't need much adjustment. You might have to adjust your elevation somewhat, but windage is generally pretty close.
Right. Looks like I'm going to have to spend $200.
I'm going to because I'm talk about a little piece that you can carry for, you know, just to have on you and take on the trap line or take into a coon tree. That's the one.
That's it. And that's the neat thing about a lot of the guns that I carry now. I shoot the Americans so much, and of course, the abuse that I give a gun is going to be different than a lot of guys because of where we go and the of course, number one, we hunt a lot, but I don't want to carry one with a beautiful stock under it anymore because I'm crawling, through fences and going through brush, and I'm a little bit hard on equipment. I try to keep them clean, but I'm a little tough on equipment.
Yeah. Well, Gary, we're closing in on an hour here. I just want to thank you again for being on. But before we go, I want to talk about Burnham Brothers Game Calls, where we can find you and Steve, did you have a Burnham Brothers?
I do. You know, Gary, back in my days at Coonhound Bloodlines magazine with the UKC, I used to write product reviews, and I did a review on coon squallers one time. And at that time, I probably reviewed maybe a dozen different types. You know, there were the old Oaks and the Johnny Stewarts, and then Timothy Ball came along with the old Weems Predator call, made it a coon squaller, and all of that. And I picked up a Burnham Brothers call, and I remember in doing that product review, that was my favorite call out of that review. Tell our listeners a little bit about your calls.
Well, Burnham Brothers was started by Winston and Murray Burnham. They were Texas boys from around Marble Falls. They started a company in 1952, and when I grew up, Murray and Winston were kind of my heroes because they traveled the world and called predators. And I tried to do a little trapping, and of course, you've got to be a pretty good trapper to set a trap well enough that a coyote will stick his foot in it. And in order for me to do that, it took me about an hour to set a trap. I decided there had to be a better way. So I got everything I could get my hands on about Burnham Brothers. I read it because I said, calling has got to be easier than this. And it was. Back in the early 60s when I started calling, very few people were calling. And, you know, most of the calling I did is, you know, as a 12-year-old kid was with a 22 single-shot rifle, but it would work, you know, because, like I say, they never had heard that. Nowadays, it seems like there's a lot more guys doing it, but so it may be a little tougher. But in the 80s, I started hunting with Murray Burnham, who had purchased his interest out from Winston. And Murray and I became good friends. And then when he sold the company in 1991, I bought it. And up until that time, of course, I was in the banking business and started out with the Federal Land Bank, made ranch loans across the state, and then I moved to Menard as president of the bank here. And anyway, decided I'd rather chase four-legged coyotes than two-legged ones. One of the real exciting things we've got coming out now is we're coming out with a new electronic caller where we have something I've been trying to do for about 20 years, but I've been working on it for the last three, is I have found the ability to record and reproduce ultrasonic sounds, which is going to be the biggest game changer since the 1950s when we first started using recorded animal sounds. There's been no improvement in sound quality until now. And I've known for years that all these animals could produce ultrasonic sounds and could hear them. Like coyotes hear up to 45,000 hertz. Bobcats can hear up to 64,000. But the calls that are on the market today, the electronic callers, are reproducing up to about 15,000 hertz. That's it. So those sounds, the first time you go into a place and use them, they may work. But that's why animals educate so quickly to them. So I've been dabbling with this ultrasonic stuff, and I can tell you, it makes a huge difference. Mm-hmm. So that will be coming out this summer.
Well, it's just one of those deals. What do humans hear at, and not me, because I can't hear anything.
We can, a human hear, you know, a youngster might, you know, 22,000 hertz. Most of us are probably in the 18 to 20 range.
Yeah. So what sounds good to our ear, you know, you have a coyote or a bobcat sitting out there thinking, what in the world is that?
Yes, sir. That's exactly right. And so we found that we've got the ability. We've got speakers now that'll go up to about 45,000 hertz. Mm. And my recording equipment will go up to 96,000 hertz. What was amazing, the first baby cottontail we recorded went over 90,000 hertz. Mm. So if you think these animals weren't making those sounds, boy, were we wrong. Mm-hmm. I recorded a lip squeaking, and I went over 50,000 hertz, just a lip squeak. Mm. So most of the sound that we're actually producing, we don't hear.
Right.
Mm. We've known
fascinating.
People, you know, isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
And of course, you've heard for years about, you know, silent dog whistles. Well, all we hear is the air going through the whistle, yet that dog can hear it.
Mm. I remember it brings back, you remember the Andy Griffith episode where Andy or Barney found Blue and kept blowing that dog whistle?
Yes. And I watch Andy Griffith every day to this day.
Come on, Blue.
Even though I've seen him all.
That was great.
Yeah, I got to throw this in. The other day, I had some drywall done at the house. We had remodeled the kitchen, and I called a guy to come out and look. And I swear to you, the guy when he came to the door, he looked like Otis Campbell. Just when just about the time he was ready to let himself into the cell. Oh, well, it's been great to talk to you, Gary. This has been a wonderful experience for me. I've enjoyed it, partner.
We're gonna have to have you back on for sure, Gary, and talk some more about those hounds and maybe get together for a hunt out in the Navajo Nation.
There we go. Say, it's easily done. Anybody can purchase a line permit out there for $250. Mm-hmm. It's number one, you're assured of getting the permit. Then you'll just need to, you know, negotiate a deal with Calvin or someone to take you. But that's, you know, that's not an expensive hunt.
Right.
Not by blind hunting standards. Mm-hmm. And the cool thing is that season opens the 1st of October and goes through the end of June.
Right. Yeah, I was going to go out this past winter.
I haven't hunted this year.
I was going to go out this past winter and miss the cutoff date for buying my lion permit, so didn't get to make that trip. Gary, tell us real quick where we can find you on social media and on the internet for Burnham Brothers Game Calls and for Carnivore TV. Let's run through that again real quick.
Well, of course, on social media, I'm old-fashioned. Battle doing any social media, but you can find us on Facebook. It's Carnivore TV, mm-hmm. Vernon Brothers as well. Or you can go to, if you're looking to, you know, to look at the calls of Vernon Brothers, just go to vernonbrothers.com. And you can find us, and welcome anybody to do that.
Sure.
I will say that I really enjoyed the visit, and it was kind of like old home week. I don't know you guys very well, but you know, in talking to you, I can tell you that you're the kind of people we like to run with and be associated with, and look forward to the next visit.
Well, that's mutual for me for sure, Gary. And just one parting shot. I've always been a romantic of sorts. And when I think about getting on a horse and having a six gun on my side and following hounds after a mountain lion, I'm not Ben Lilly. He walked. But I'm with the Lee brothers, and I'm in the Old West, and man, it's been a great visit.
You bet.
Thank you so much.
You bet, Gary. Thank you. And Steve, we've been working on a signature tagline for this show.
Yeah.
And you remember what you told me you were going to say at the conclusion of every show.
The words of an old West Virginia bear hunter that I admire very much. Chris, you follow your dog, and I'll follow mine.